welcome to the Xyphos podcast with your host, Paul Miller. Today I talk with Stephen Downes, who works at the National Research Council of Canada. Stephen is perhaps best known for his OL Daily newsletter, and I talk to him about this and about some of his views on the educational technology space. Towards the end of the call, we dig into some projects that Stephen is involved with. For more information on this show and others in the series, please see the show notes on our website. Thank you. Stephen, thank you very much for joining me for this podcast today. Before we talk about OL Daily and some of the work that you're involved in, can you give listeners a little bit of background about yourself and where you came from, please?
Sure. Well, I work for the National Research Council Institute for Information Technology here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, where at the moment it is very cold. And I've worked here since 2001. I was hired from the University of Alberta, where I was working as an information architect. And I had worked at Assiniboine Community College prior to that, doing online learning, putting up their website, training all their staff, etc. So I have a long background in the field of online learning, which is what brought me to the NRC now. And what I do now is a mixture of writing, of programming, of speaking, of general agitation, and some project work.
Okay, and you are certainly very visible online and at events around the world. How much of that is you, doing it in your own time, and how much of that is what NRC pays you to do?
Well, that's a very murky question, actually. It's interesting because OL Daily, which is my newsletter, started up before I joined NRC and may have been part of the reason why I was brought to NRC. It's sort of hard to say. Now, I do OL Daily ostensibly as part of my work with NRC, which is to say NRC is supportive of it and is happy for me to do it on job time, although I pay for the web server myself and maintain the whole downs.ca website out of my own pocket. So it's a bit murky, but I don't really care about the ownership of it a whole lot. So murky is fine with me, and I think it's fine with NRC too.
Okay, so they're quite happy for you to be doing all the background work that requires. Good.
Oh, yes. It's because, I mean, we both recognize that this feeds directly into my work as a researcher. The reading that I do for OL Daily is research. It's me going out there and finding out what's happening in the world of education technology and bringing it back. And I happen to put that in OL Daily on the way by, but it feeds directly into the research that I do, and that's why they're supportive of it.
Okay, and OL Daily is, you know, one of those resources that I think everyone in this space keeps an eye on. I know it certainly pops into my email each night and into my RSS reader every morning as well. I should probably unsubscribe from one of them, as it's the same content. There's a vast amount of stuff in there. How do you keep up, and how much time does it take?
The latter question I can answer fairly precisely. It takes me about 2 hours a day. And I know that fairly precisely because, you know, it's one of these things I need to manage my time. It could expand to take up a full day if I let it. The way I do it, I've got a lot of systems in place by now. I mean, I've been doing it for more than 10 years. So I have the various mailing lists that I subscribe to, and so that, of course, comes straight into my email reader. I subscribe to a large-ish number of RSS feeds from, pretty much everyone who's writing a blog in the field of educational technology or related areas. So all the information comes to me. I don't really go out looking for it. It comes to me. And then in the preparation of the newsletter, I have my own software that I've written called Grasshopper, which manages most of the work in putting the newsletter together. All I do is when I find something interesting, I fill out a form, hit submit, and then the software does the rest for me.
Okay, so simplifying and streamlining the process, certainly. Do you get a lot of people pitching you, cover my exciting new story, or do we accept that you just find the content that interests you by your own means?
It comes and goes. Right now, this week, yeah, quite a bit. I've had a lot recently, a surprising amount, which means somewhere Well Daily and my email address have popped up in some discussion list or forum or something somewhere. And so I'll have a wave of it for a while, and then it'll trickle off. And then I'll get an upsurge again. And so, like I say, it comes and goes.
Okay.
I'm not a reliable place to advertise because I don't always pick up the stuff. In fact, I pick up a very little amount of the stuff I'm pitched. I do pick up some, though, so it does come back. They do keep pitching me.
Right, and presumably you find some value in that, too. Occasionally there's
a story
that's really interesting.
Sometimes people are pitching stuff that is worthwhile and useful and worth sharing. So that stuff I certainly want to pass along, and I'm happy that I've been pitched it. But that's, it's a minority.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Okay, so you've been doing OL Daily for a while, and through that, getting actually quite a good view of what's going on in the educational technology space, certainly as represented by the blogosphere and the mailing lists. Looking back on it, presumably you sort of started off with quite high hopes of the ways in which educational technology was going to transform learning, and the high hopes that I think a lot of us entered the space with. Are you disappointed by where we are now, or do you think we're actually doing quite well?
I don't think either of those options is the answer to the question. And I'm not sure I would characterize my initial approach as having been one of high hopes. So, in a sense, I have to reframe the question a bit. I came into the field, first of all, by accident. And I think that really changes your perspective. I came into the field from a background in philosophy and entered it, first of all, as a distance education instructor, which I did with Athabasca University for 7 years, and then, as I've indicated, the technological work that I did at Assiniboine and the University of Alberta. And it's one of these things where I was just each step of the way drawn a bit further and a bit further and a bit further in. So it's always been, for me, a question of what I can do, what I can make the technology do, where I can get the technology to take me, rather than some sort of agenda for the field as a whole. I don't really have huge hopes for the field as a whole, and I'll have to characterize that sentence now. And by that, what I mean is that I don't have hope or faith that large institutions will easily change. And in fact, when I'm asked where I think the change will come from in our discipline, my answer is typically from outside the institutions. And I still believe that that's the case. So when I look at the state of the field now, I look at it from two very different perspectives. On the one hand, from the perspective of the institutions, which have, as one would expect, taken the technology they find appropriate and having co-opted it for their own purposes, have basically replicated what they've always done, which is to say learning management systems and student information systems and the like. And so it's kind of unimaginative, doing the same thing as always sort of approach to technology. But then on the other hand, I look at the work that's being done outside the institutions, things, the wide range from Google to Wikipedia to open educational resources to the blogosphere to the mailing lists and all of the rest. And I see this huge, huge location of activity I wanted to say seething cauldron, but that sounded a bit too dramatic. And that excites me. I find that work very interesting, very imaginative, very creative, and it's to there that I return every day. And I get ideas from it, and I like to think that I seed my ideas into it.
So do you think that all these things that are going on in the informal space, or actually, you know, in a space where select members of institutions are engaging off their own back, pretty much, do you think that that space stands to disrupt what the institutions are doing, or will they quite happily continue for years to come, effectively just applying learning technologies to preserving their status quo?
They will disrupt the institutions. The institutions will nonetheless carry on. I mean, they will carry on long after their usefulness has ended because they're large and they have a lot of inertia. But they will be disrupted. They have been disrupted. Universities didn't want anything to do with this whole technology thing anyways, and only very reluctantly began using things like learning management systems. They didn't want to do things like record their lectures, but now their lectures are being recorded and their content is being put out there as open courseware. You know, all of these are things that the institutions had no intention of doing, no desire to do, but nonetheless they're doing it. And, you know, with each iteration, with each development in this informal space, you see the institutions being pushed a little bit at a time, bit by bit, toward the brink. And, you know, I've always represented the situation as one where the institutions will suddenly find themselves in a crisis that developed from their perspective overnight, but which has been building for years, a crisis where the traditional ways of doing things, of having a residential university and lecturers in classrooms and things like that, are irrelevant and not seen to be worth funding by our governmental institutions, who will quite rightly, after a certain point of time, view them as social clubs for rich people.
Yes, and presumably clubs for people who are sufficiently self-motivated to get out and push some of these things themselves as well. I mean, that actually raises an issue about some of the online resources that we're beginning to see spring up, and some of the online practices we're beginning to see as well. In theory, they're open to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But in practice, they appeal to a certain kind of person, don't they? You know, this myth that every student's on Facebook when they arrive at university. Yes, a lot of them are, but actually some of them aren't, for all sorts of reasons, either choice or ability or whatever it might be. Are we in danger of leaving a cohort behind, or is that not our problem, even if it's true?
That's an interesting way of phrasing the question. You know, in Canada, internet penetration among the young is well into the 90%. I think something like 96 or 97%. And they may not all use Facebook per se, but they're all in one way or another connected. And by all, I mean quite literally all. It's the very rare person who isn't in some way or another plugged in. Now, of course, that doesn't globalize, and different countries have different penetration rates. Whether the issue with access be inability to afford the technology or disinclination to use the technology, you know, these are going to be issues. But they're not as big an issue as is sometimes made out to be. I think, and I observe, that we are, as a planet, moving steadily in the direction of global access. Ubiquitous access, 100% access. And more, I'm seeing that it's less and less the case that there are any reasons for somebody not to access the internet. Just, you know, and you might think, well, that's incredible. How could that be? But in the same way, you know, people access roads. And you know, the accessibility of roads is basically 100%. That doesn't mean everybody goes out and drives, but they could, you know, and they may use alternative modes of transportation as well. That's okay. I know that sounds a little bit confused, but, you know, because, you know, you look at the situation now and it really looks like, oh no, we're leaving people behind because they don't have access. And we have to look at this in a historical context. Our education system has always omitted a certain percentage of people. And our formal education system, you know, leaves behind or leaves out, I think is probably a more accurate term, you know, huge percentages of the population. Even in Canada, 20-30% do not take post-secondary education. And in countries in Africa or South America or Asia, these percentages are significantly higher. So I think that compared to that, access to the internet is an improvement. That access is growing, that it's easier to get people to access the internet than it is to get them into the post-secondary education system. And so I see nothing but good news out of all of this. I'm looking at the direction in which we're moving rather than focusing on the fact that we are not now reaching 100% of the people. Does that make sense?
It does. Yes, it absolutely does. And there are certainly initiatives in Canada, as there are here in Europe, to ensure that even if you don't have a computer or internet access in your home, you have ready access to the network through things like your local public library.
Quite right.
There are programs in place.
In Canada, about 10 years ago, we launched a thing called the Community Access Program. And it's funny because I just posted a picture of one on Flickr 2 days ago. And basically, we put the internet into pretty much every library and community across the country. And that was 10 years ago. And these were locally managed and locally run. They weren't centrally operated. And they became not just internet access points, but community organization points. And we really built on that. And that's what has created the conditions of access we have here today.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So reaching back a bit to earlier in our conversation, we were speaking about the rather traditional way that big institutions have appropriated some of these ideas and some of these technologies. So they've essentially deployed course management systems as monolithic blocks that everything's sucked into, whether students or teachers want it or not. And the sort of the corollary to that has been a far more disjointed but interconnected set of tools that the individuals have started to put on their desktops. It's things like, you know, their RSS reader and email and all these other tools that they're using to drive their own learning and their own education. And loosely, this sort of grouping of tools has in the past been talked about as sort of, you know, it could be a personal learning environment juxtaposed to the virtual learning environment or course management system from the institution. Now, you're about to start some project work in this PLE space. So what are you going to be doing?
Well, that's quite right. And in one sense, the project is to obtain some sort of understanding of what it is that a personal learning environment is and what we're trying to do with a personal learning environment. And on the other hand, the project is an actual construction project to create some tools that allow people to manage their own personal learning environment. And by that, what I mean is to provide people with a space where they can organize their access to the many tools that they use out there on the internet, whether it be email, RSS feeds, services like Flickr or Amazon or eBay, archive sites like Open Archives Initiative or Internet Archives, and the rest. And the idea here is to facilitate their interactions with the rest of the internet. What distinguishes what we're up to with what you would normally see is normally people who are creating internet software are creating destination sites. And a learning management system is a destination site. And the idea of a destination site is that it's something that you go to and it's an environment of some sort. It might be MySpace, it might be Facebook, it might be Flickr or Yahoo or whatever. But you go there, and even though you can personalize your interface with it and create your own little personal space on it, it is nonetheless an environment that you are sharing with other people, which is how they set up all these social connections and the like. It is an environment that is, in important respects, separated or isolated or in siloed away from the rest of the internet. And it is an environment that is owned by an external entity, whether that be Yahoo or the university or whatever. And what we want to build is something that will be identifiably personal, that it is not something that you are sharing with other people. It is not something that is owned by some external entity, but rather something that is yours, that you manage, that you control, and that you own. And you might say, well, that creates, you know, some sort of solitary presence. But the whole point of this sort of personal learning environment is that it is densely connected to other instances of the same thing. So your personal learning environment connects to the personal learning environments of all your friends, and the business learning environment of, say, the institution, or the social learning environment of some organization. And the idea here is that the community is created by connecting instances of the personal learning environment rather than creating a destination.
Okay. So what sort of form do you see a tool like this taking? I guess on one level, is this a desktop client or is it a web page I go to? And how does it interact with all my existing footprints in these spaces?
Yeah, well, those are good questions and part of, and are a big reason why we're actually building a project out of this rather than just having some guy in an office do some coding. I view my own software, Grasshopper, as an initial instance of a personal learning environment, a prototype personal learning environment, and Grasshopper is web-based software, which I access through a browser. That works really well. So that's my starting point, but I think that when we get the team together, that'll be one of the first questions that we ask, and indeed we may look at a range of applications varying from the desktop to the iPhone version to the web top or the web-based application, and focus on the engine that's running behind it, so that it doesn't really matter what form it takes. It matters what it does. That's my thinking at this point, and you know, this team will certainly inform me on that. As for how it will communicate with the rest, that part is actually fairly well understood, because a lot of that's happening already. We see things like RSS or Atom feeds, for example, sending blog posts and Flickr images and Twitter messages back and forth between people. We see application program interfaces, APIs, being used to access specific sites like Blogger, for example. There's a Blogger API. Flickr, there's a Flickr API, etc. We see emerging standards like OpenID and OAuth, which are used to propagate a person's identity across the web so that you are the same person no matter what external site that you're touching. And so there's a whole range of these standards and protocols that have developed over the year that will be integrated into software such as this.
Okay. And is the funding for this coming from NRC?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Right now it's 100% NRC funded. So, and it's going to involve the hiring of five dedicated staff in addition to myself over a period of 3 years, so you can sort of guess from that the range of the funding. And You know, we will be scouting, you know, quite diligently for commercial partners, because there should be a commercial side to this. But that said, our first intent is to release open source software, because the network of personal learning environments doesn't exist unless it's used. And the only way to make it used is to make the software freely accessible.
Yes, yes, indeed. So where can we follow along? Presumably on your site, but is there a dedicated site for the project?
Not yet, but there will be. But there isn't one yet.
Okay, so keep a watch out on OL Daily for the news when it does
appear.
Yeah. Okay, good. I guess reaching back to a previous activity, last year you ran this connectivism course with George Siemens, which seemed to attract quite a lot of interest. What were you trying to achieve there, and did you?
Survival. sorry. Although it's kind of funny. What we were trying to do is see if we could make it work. This is how I work on the internet. This is how a certain type of researcher works on the internet. You try something, you see if it works. And if it works, you've discovered something. And if it doesn't work, you've discovered something else. But the idea is to try it out. And so what we wanted to do is to try it out. And what we were trying to try out is connectivism. And connectivism, which was the topic of the course, it's all wonderfully recursive, and the programmer in me likes that. But the idea here was to have a course that was distributed, that was created or composed out of a network of interactions between participants, rather than being based on a single, solitary, central, authoritative source. We kind of hit the halfway mark. We hit the halfway mark because it was offered through the University of Manitoba, so it had to be a formal course in a certain sense. And so it had to have an instructor, or in this case, it had two instructors, George and myself. And it had to have some students, at least, who were signed up and paying tuition, which we did. We had a number of people paying tuition, enough to pay for our costs. So consequently, we had to have a curriculum that we followed, and we did that. We had a series of 12 weeks worth of subjects that we went one subject to the next. But beyond that basic structure, we kept the courses decentralized and disorganized as possible. And we told the students at the beginning of the course two things. First of all, that they were encouraged to create their own learning environment, that they did not need to use ours, and indeed that there would be good reason for them to set up their own learning environment rather than to attempt to use ours, and many of them did. And we got a whole bunch of different learning environments that were set up. And then secondly, that the model of instruction in the course was such that they were not expected to consume everything, that this was not a course where we would shovel up the content and they would ingest it. And in fact, with 2,200 students in the course, there would be too much material for anyone to consume, even the instructors. And so the idea is that each student would have their own individual perspective on the material, and then would learn by communicating from that perspective with other students. And so that was the model of the learning. The model of the learning was learning based on point of view and communication rather than presentation and consumption. And so we structured the course deliberately to encourage that form of learning. And so that's what we were testing. And from that perspective, I think it worked quite well.
Okay. Would you do it again? Would Manitoba do it again?
Oh, we are going to do it again. we're looking at doing it again, another connectivism course next fall. You know, it hasn't been formally put into place, but George and I have talked about it, and we're certainly up for another one. And I would like to try it with a different subject. I'm thinking of doing a critical thinking course or something like that.
Interesting. So, presumably technology was quite important to the course. Did the technology get in the way, or did it empower the course, or was it simply background to allow the actual conversation to take place?
It was all of those things, because there was no one technology, right? We used a lot of different things, some of which were set up by George and myself, and some of which were set up by the students. So just to quickly list, we had synchronous discussions in Illuminate and Skype and Ustream. We had forums in Moodle and in Grasshopper. We had the newsletter that came out through Grasshopper. We had Google Groups. We had a Second Life areas were set up. And there's more. I'm just trying to list these off the top of my head. There's another 10 more items that were used. Somebody diagrammed it, and it looked like, well, just they filled an eight, or, you know, a big sheet of paper with the diagram of all the different components. Some of these worked really well. Some of these worked partially well. Some of these weren't even noticeable. For example, the Ustream choked on us. We couldn't make the Ustream send out enough audio and video streams for the audience that we had. So we fell back on Illuminate on a number of occasions. The Moodle forums turned out to be too centralized, with the result that a small number of people dominated the discussion, which was not what we were after. And one of the things we did in the Moodle forum was to tell people to leave the Moodle forum and go somewhere else. Go create their own group somewhere, which is what they did. The Google group that one student set up wasn't used a whole lot. I think they had about 7 people and 20 messages, and sort of just faded into the background. And so different technologies performed differently, as one would expect, and performed differently based on the qualities of the technology, but also the nature of the user and the nature of the usage.
Right, that's interesting. I had a post on ZDNet yesterday, actually, talking about the different places in which semantic web conversations take place. And, you know, one of the points I think I was trying to get at with that post was that all this choice on one level is a good thing, because it means we pick the tools appropriate to the job and appropriate to our personality and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But actually it also fragments the conversation. So how do we manage that fragmentation?
Uh-huh. Well, and that's where Grasshopper came in. Grasshopper, recall, is my prototype personal learning environment. And there was only one instance of it, my own. So it wasn't a perfect use of that system, nonetheless. What I did was to aggregate the content using RSS, because Grasshopper is an RSS aggregator, among other things. So I brought different people's blog posts. There were about 170 student blogs that were created, for example, message board posts, Flickr photos, etc. Grasshopper aggregated them together. And then out of that, and out of the curriculum, which we posted on a wiki, I created a daily newsletter, which I called, unimaginatively, The Daily. And then that got sent out. And so people would receive that, either by email or by RSS, whatever they preferred, and would click on the links, and then they would be sent to these different environments all over the internet where some interaction was happening. And so The Daily forms this thread that wove through this entire network of interaction.
So email underpins all of this Web 2 stuff.
email and RSS. And it was about, it's about half and half these days. For my newsletter, OL Daily, I have about twice to three times as many RSS readers as email readers. And for the daily in the course, it was about 50% of each, RSS and email. And I assume a few people looked at it on the website, but that's always a distant third.
Yes. Good. So The connectivism course then was one approach to, you know, delivering an educational experience. One of the other ones you're looking at is this whole idea of serialized feeds, which intrigued me. So what are you trying to do there?
That's something that I'm working on as we speak, and hopefully by the time people listen to this audio, it will actually exist out there in the world. But the idea here is to create an RSS feed composed of a series of entities, a series of posts, where the delivery of these posts begins at the point when a student or a person subscribes to the RSS feed. So the idea is there a time-based delivery of content.
Okay, so it could, for example, be, you know, one post a day, starting whenever.
Starting whenever, exactly. So the idea of serialized feeds has been around for a couple of years, and where it has been used before is to read a book. And the idea is that you don't want to start a book at chapter 14 or whatever. You want to start a book at chapter 1. But we don't know when you're going to subscribe to the feed. So when you subscribe to the feed, you get chapter 1. And then tomorrow you get chapter 2 and so on. And the idea of serialized feeds is to take this concept, but to apply it, first of all, to an educational context, and secondly, to a network context. So it's not simply the delivery of chapters of books, but rather the creation of the set of interrelated activities that kicks off when you sign up for the course.
Okay, so you're going to try that with this upcoming course, or are we going to see an example of it sooner than that?
Oh, we'll see examples of that sooner. I'm sort of, like I said, I'm about partway through, most of the way through, I hope, writing the software now. I'm writing it on my Grasshopper platform. And what I intend to do once I have the whole thing working, it turns out to be a lot harder to write than you might think. I'm going to create some sample versions. I'll do a book just to make sure that it's delivering books properly. And then I'll set it off distributing some educational material. So when people go to it, they'll be able to see some samples, they can sign up for some feeds and see the feeds being delivered to their RSS reader in sequence. I'm also setting it up so that people can create their own serialized feeds. I mean, this is very important. I want it to be something that other people can use to create things and not something that I simply use to deliver things. And then once I have that basic platform built, then I'll begin to add on some of the extras. And it's once I have the extras added on that I can use it for one of our courses. Because the course that George and I offered, for example, was a lot more complex than simply the time-based delivery of content.
Yes, it was. Sounds interesting. It'd be good to see how that goes. I'm conscious of the time. So before we wrap up, are there any sort of closing comments you would like to make? Your view from Manitoba on the state of the sector and where we're going?
Oh, well, I'm not in Manitoba.
New Brunswick. Sorry, New Brunswick. I knew that. I was looking at the wrong note on a bit of paper.
That's fine. Yeah, because the course is based in Manitoba. And it's funny because that's typical. Like, Manitoba is about 3,000 kilometers from where I'm sitting. And it feels like it's next door. And in fact, I used to live there. And that's pretty typical of the environment that we're working in today, where these distances become almost meaningless. And we're discovering different ways of connecting across these distances. That's going to be, in the long run, a lot more important than people think. Right now, it's pretty easy to travel back and forth. But, you know, as time goes by, it's going to get harder to travel these distances again, simply because of the costs of fuel and transportation. And these webs that we're creating now are going to be all the more important to keeping the fabric of society intact, as it becomes harder and harder to actually see each other.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm certainly conscious in my own work. I seem to spend more time talking to people in North America than round the corner. And I think my family would probably agree, but they're not very happy about it.
It's funny because, you know, when I grew up, I never imagined that I would talk to people and know people who lived in these other parts of the world. It was just beyond the scope of comprehension that this could be the case. So it's interesting that this is how it's worked out.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And there's some interesting things going on, so which hopefully will continue. It's an interesting time to be working in this space. So thank you very much for your time, Stephen, and I do hope you will keep up OL Daily. It's certainly one of the things I read each day. And I look forward to seeing how these new projects work out as well. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.